All right, everybody. Mr. Charles K. Ortel serves as managing partner of Newport Value Partners, LLC, Newport, established in 07, providing value-added research to executives and to investment firms. From 94 to 02, Mr. Ortel was president of the Chart Group, LP, a private investment and advisory firm, which he helped found with another partner. While at Chart, Mr. Ortel helped create and manage an Irish corporate buyout fund, a small-cap U.S. buyout fund, a French petroleum development company, a U.S. natural gas distribution company, and an offshore fund of hedge funds. He served as chairman, president, and director of numerous Chart-sponsored companies, and as an outside director of Ted Castle Holdings Limited and Ariel Corporation. From 91 to 94, he was senior managing director and member of the management committee at the Bridgeford Group, Inc. From 1980 to 91, he also worked for Dillon, Reed & Company, Inc. Trained in corporate finance, Mr. Ortel eventually served in a senior capacity within Dillon Reed's corporate buyout department before leading Dillon Reed's worldwide merger and acquisition group as managing director. He graduated from Harvard Business School with an MBA and from Yale University with a BA, cum laude. Now, let's put it this way. He's doing some Clinton Foundation work as a private citizen because he cares that charities, and in particular U.S. charities, operating around the work by famous Americans, are run properly in compliance with applicable state, federal, and foreign laws. So in describing him, you might consider simply stating he's an investor and former merger and acquisition specialist with decades of experience inside and outside the United States. So the first thing I'm going to ask him is, why did you choose to examine the Clinton Foundation in such detail? First time on the program, it's a great pleasure to welcome Mr. Charles Ortel. Welcome, Charles. Good to have you. Thanks for coming.
Well, thanks for having me on, John. Actually, I think the Clinton Foundation, almost by chance, many months ago, I had come up with this idea that there's a market for a new newsletter service catering to people who have money, want to figure out how to manage it, want to figure out where to good charities to give money to, and also who care and believe that this country is truly exceptional. These are three areas that I care a lot about. I know a fair bit about managing money. I know a fair bit about the history of this great country, indeed going back into England and earlier times. And I have served on the boards of two charities, but I really, until last year, did not understand the degree to which any citizen can find out a lot of information about the Clintons, about a foundation. And when I had heard, somebody was telling me that the Clinton Foundation was doing all this great work, but that nobody could really understand what it truly did. That piqued my interest. And I said, you know what? I got some spare time. Let me take a look at the Clinton Foundation filings to see what they tell me. And, you know, I fully expected in this case, I'll just say right up front, I don't like the Clintons. I don't like what they've done politically. But I'm not really that much involved in politics. And I was more interested to see, you know, these are smart people, all three of them. Bill, Hillary, and Chelsea all have multiple graduate-level degrees from great schools. They have a lot of money, so they could pay for good advisors, and I expected their filings to be fantastic. Instead, last year, I quickly reached the conclusion that this was unprosecuted charity fraud.
Unprosecuted charity fraud. You're using the F word.
Yeah, well, see, for charity fraud is different than the kind of fraud that you would see in a for-profit setting like Enron or WorldCom or, you know, the big frauds that are very well known. In a charity, people operating a charity are not allowed to operate a charity for private gain, for profit. So, and the rules are normally quite strict on this. So that, you know, when you operate a charity, the IRS typically gets interested in your filings because they're late or there's an error in them. They're going to ask, you know, how much profit would be created if this charity didn't exist? And the rules are so tight that if the IRS were to determine the aggregate collective profit, not the profit, you know, by one person on one deal, but the total profit created through the operation of this charity, in other cases, if it has been more than $1,000, in actual fact, more than low hundreds, the IRS has severely punish the charity, in most cases shutting it down. And so when I saw that, the rules, the state rules on establishing state laws, foreign laws, and other laws establishing what constitutes charity fraud, charity solicitation and operating fraud, removed the obligation of the prosecutor to prove that the fraudster intended to commit the fraud or that the fraudster derived a personal gain. All you have to show on charity fraud is that the filings that are issued by the charity are false and materially misleading, which I will tell you they are, and that the charity continuously or continued while these false filings were in the public domain to solicit funds using either telephones, mails, or digital media, which the Clintons admit that they currently are doing as we speak. You don't have to prove that they knew they were committing fraud. You just have to prove that the filings are false, materially misleading, and that they're still soliciting.
Okay. So why has no one looked into this before, I wonder?
Well, I asked that question, and what you discover is that the person who is in charge, you know, the way the IRS works, there are approximately a million or more charities like the Clinton Foundation. Not many are as big as the Clinton Foundation, but there are quite a few of them. And the IRS, like other parts of our government, federal, state, and local, is thinly staffed. The person who had the responsibility for oversight of the difficult period in the Clinton Foundation when it changed its mission illegally was none other than Lois Lerner. She was put in that position in January of 2001 and held it through December 2005. Thereafter, from January 2006 until mid-2013, she was in charge of the entire operation that looked to regulated charities. So one piece of the puzzle we know is that for a period of time, chiefly after 2009, the IRS and this division under Lerner decided to hassle, it would seem, Tea Party and other conservative groups. So far, people haven't focused on the flip side of the coin, which is they may well have given a pass to the Clinton Foundation and to other left-leaning foundations whose filings are false and materially misleading.
Is this normally a jailable offense upon conviction?
This is a, well, I'll tell you what. If you read the verbiage that's out there and you look into various bad cases, one that started here in New York after September 11, 2001, unfortunately, when disaster strikes, the worst, you know, fraudsters and crooks come out of the woodwork and try to associate themselves with what are called disaster relief charity fraud. Even after September 11, 2001, when, you know, downtown portions of our city and then the Pentagon, of course, the poor field in Pennsylvania, you know, were all stricken so adversely, wouldn't you know that a bunch of creeps came at it and stole money that was intended for disaster relief. This is a pattern, sadly, you see time after time after time. Well, after that period, the sentencing guidelines for disaster relief charity fraud, which this is, you know, it started with Bill Clinton's involvement, the name of the Clinton Foundation, supposedly helping people who had suffered in an earthquake in India, Gujarat, India, January 2001. It continued to the tsunami, and then to Katrina, and then to Gulf Coast, and now in Haiti. The penalties for disaster relief solicitation and operating fraud are strict. You know, not just jail time, long jail time. And the way it works normally is you're penalized not for the amount of money you take, but for the amount of money you solicit. So if you do a million email campaigns to a million different people, each email solicitation can be a serious crime.
Well, that doesn't sound good. You know, you know, an earthquake in India, I can kind of see that. I wonder if there was any Hurricane Sandy, you know, charity contributions that were supposed to be made that weren't, for example.
Well, you see, that's where we get to a central point of this whole operation. When you look into the ways in which charities are supposed to file, the IRS and the state regulators and the foreign regulators are actually quite clever. Normally, they require a charity above a relatively small size. Clinton's revenues are in the hundreds of millions per year, their declared revenues, and above about $500,000, typically you have to get a real accounting firm, not, you know, a bunch of people operating on the second floor of a strip mall, but a serious accounting firm has to go in and check management's work and the trustees' work, and they have to produce what's called an independent audit. It's not the kind of audit when the tax team comes to you and says, you know, you missed something in your personal form. It's an income statement. It's a balance sheet. It's a cash flow statement. It's financial footnotes. It all has to reconcile. It all has to check. So that auditor normally will figure out whether there's missing money. And the pattern of these disaster relief and other charities that are poorly run is that, you know, something happens and there's like the equivalent of an 800 number. There's an internet spot where you can go to send $5 or $10 or $20, and millions of people will do that. And the first part of the scam is whether or not all the incoming monies are declared. Because the clever, in quotes, fraudsters can, you know, say, let's say they collect $2 billion. They can say, well, you know, we did a really great job. We collected $100 million, and they can steal $1.9 billion. And that's the magnitude we're talking about here. When I look at all elements of the Clinton charity fraud network, I get to, total size from October 23, 1997 to the present, which is what I know today, of $100 billion.
You're using the word billion.
Yes.
$100 billion.
Yes, sir.
Charles, you are completely at liberty to say whatever you wish, and I'm sure that I'll join in with you. I find these people to be, it is my opinion, that you talk about a Teflon family, all the scandal, all of these crooked dealings, Vincent Foster, you know, the Benghazi deal. I even heard a rumor, that, now we're talking about charities now, but just between ourselves and, you know, few hundred thousand people. I heard that there was an arms company. I was looking to buy a military vehicle just to go crash around out in the boonies in. You know, I didn't know what was really out there. So I asked this guy who brokers in this stuff, and he said, yeah, I'll look into it. And he said, you know, I've heard that Bill Clinton is involved in a company in Texas with that. So he called his contact down there and just casually mentioned, hey, I heard Bill Clinton's got a little bit of this action. And the guy said, I got to go, and hung up the phone, and he never heard from him again. So, I mean, these people have had their fingers in all kinds of pies for a long time. And, of course, you know, the nicest thing they could possibly come up with would be, I know, the Clinton Foundation. We help people. It's like these people have done nothing but help themselves. These are politically connected grifters, and I'll just leave it at that. Now, my having said that, you can say anything you want.
All right. Well, I'll tell you. I mean, actually, when I started on this, I wrote an article from Breitbart on the 16th of March, 2015, entitled, With So Many Red Flags, Why Hasn't the IRS Audited the Clinton Foundation? And generally, a topic that dense doesn't get a lot of Facebook shares, which is one metric to think, you know, who's watching and who's reading this thing. When that came out back in March, it got around 67,000 Facebook shares, which is not bad. And then earlier this year, of course, still out on the internet, when Brian Pagliano, that security guy, he was under investigation, and now today we learned criminal investigation, it jumped to 15,000. Then a number of weeks back, it jumped to 30,000. This morning when I checked, it's almost 38,000 Facebook shares. So a lot of people around the world are beginning to study this, because this is a global fraud. In April of 2015, I wrote the first document on my website concerning the Clinton Foundation frauds, and it's what I call the first foundation report. And the title of the report was False Philanthropy in Question Mark. And I bring that up because people who don't understand or are not all that familiar with how charities are supposed to work and what the tripwires are will enjoy reading this. But most importantly, your listeners will be perhaps gratified to learn that it's actually the bottom 80% of Americans that gives the biggest percentage to charity. It's not Bill Gates. It's not Warren Buffett. It's not the multi-billionaires. It's the everyday mom and pop and children oftentimes who from an early age, you know, they hear tales of woe. And, you know, we're a rich country. As much trouble as we have compared to the 65 other countries I've visited in my lifetime, there are many, many countries on this planet, sadly, that are in horrible condition and likely will remain in horrible condition. And people in America know this. So when they hear tales of woe, what they do is, you know, they put off that extra cup of coffee or that drink or that restaurant meal, and they send 5, 10, 15, 20 bucks into charity. Oftentimes, they're far more generous than that. And the statistics put out by our government in what they claim is the best set of statistics available, the so-called consumer expenditure survey, prove that, categorically prove that. And I put those statistics out in this first foundation report. So why do people do that? Because, they assume that, the likelihood that anybody would try to steal from a charity or divert money from a charitable cause is so low that when they see big names associated with a charity, a big law firm, a big accounting firm named in these documents, they conclude that a former president of the United States, even a challenged one, such as Bill Clinton, and, I have my own issues with the Bush family, the people like the Clintons and the Bushes, when they independently or jointly operate charities, but they would take the requisite care to make sure that the monies that were sent to the charity actually went solely to the purposes for which they were intended, and that all laws were properly cared for. Not so in the Clinton Foundation. And, so the issue here, for those of us who care about this country, we have a lot of charities, American charities, that have been operating outside the United States of America, doing great stuff, oftentimes, in great peril. And when I saw the Clinton Foundation operating so much at variance with the law, I said, we got to make an example of this. We got to teach these people a lesson for two reasons. First, because what they're doing is just simply dead wrong and horrible. But beyond that, we got to help our American charities that are operating abroad so that the people around the world understand that when a crooked one comes to light, it gets punished and the good ones can still keep operating. I mean, Vladimir Putin, who we can all have differences of opinion on some of the things that he's done. But he made a case a number of years ago, not necessarily pointing on the Clinton Foundation, saying that the reason he's tough on charity is because he doesn't really understand what some of these American and foreign charities are doing inside his country. This is a common complaint. The Chinese have said the same thing. The Indians the same thing. And here's a case in point that proves that foreign countries should actually be suspicious. We have a former president. We have an aspiring president. We have a very smart and spoiled, frankly, daughter operating a charity in flagrant disregard of applicable state, federal, and foreign laws. And they haven't been doing it for a week. They've been doing it since October 23rd, 1997.
Good Lord, man. All right, so what's the next step? What can be done as a result of, or what could happen, is a better way to put it, as a result of this investigation? I understand you're going to go on to a big news channel here in just a little while. I mean, can we expect maybe some action on this? Because, look, these people, what is this woman doing running for president? How is this even possible? It just seems to me that that this country's political structure has deteriorated and, worse, degenerated to the point that nothing gets done. Both parties seem to cancel each other out. Charles, seriously, I could just go crazy with this. It's like, we don't even know who the president really is. We really don't. And, in the meantime, people are watching their sports and they're doing this and they're getting distracted. It's a big deal. And, now we've got a mass shooting down there. And I thought to myself, we're about due for another mass shooting. I mean, I haven't heard a major gun control push here in the last few months. So let's see what happens. And sure as hell, we have one down in Orlando. And I'm thinking to myself, is this bunch really the best that we can do? I am sure that there are some people up there who are good people who actually love the country, love the Constitution, love the law, but they're not the ones getting the camera time. So what about this?
Well, it's the oldest question in history, in modern history. Who regulates the regulator?
Yeah, right.
And the answer is, we the people. Now, in the narrow and specific case that you raised with the Clinton Foundation, I will break some news with you. There is a related entity called Laureate Education. Now, I didn't spot this myself. Peter Schweitzer points it out in his book. Now, Laureate is a large collection of universities scattered around the world and improperly controlled from Baltimore, Maryland. That is a for-profit string of higher education universities. Now, in my experience investing, every time somebody would comes to me with an idea, they don't come to me with an idea because they intend to lose money. There's always some big story about how trees are going to grow to the sky and blah, 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 blah. So I always don't listen to that, and I ask instead, the first questions I concentrate upon at first are, what risks are you asking me to take? Now, this will shock your listeners, and perhaps you. There is one area I've found where I actually agree with the Obama administration, and that's where they've been going after recently, schools that try to induce vulnerable students to take on subprime and expensive loans to get involved with suspect for-profit education. I think that is a ridiculous concept in most cases. This is one of the prime offenders of that. This is Laureate Education. So what happened here is that after 2007, according to, there is a quick answer to this, but I got to urge you there by giving you some background. After 2007, an element of the Clinton Foundation that was illegally formed in 2005 and has been illegally operated since then, called the Clinton Global Initiative, which is not a charity. It's a big party where people get together, brag about what they might do in the future, and it is certainly not either validly organized or reported on properly in the public domain. This entity decided to team with Laureate and create a university. Now, in the last week to 10 days up here in New York, the press has been filled with stories about Trump University. That's a $40 million potential problem where it is alleged Trump's people may have formed an entity that doesn't comply with the strict state and other laws that govern the use of the word university, particularly in a for-profit setting. Laureate, in contrast, is a $4 billion problem.
Wow.
And worse, Laureate is in the midst right now of trying to do it, two types of financing, meaning that the SEC, our Securities and Exchange Commission in Washington, D.C., is certainly watching and should be investigating Laureate. Well, one piece of the Laureate filing that is not done properly is they don't disclose the payments that Bill and Hillary Clinton got between 2010 and 2015. Now, I don't know how many of your listeners are able to get this type of compensation, but let me tell you what has been admitted so far, and that is that from 2010 to 2015, Bill Clinton, by extension Hillary, earned $16.5 million for part-time work solely in connection with his role as supposed chancellor of these Laureate universities around the world. That's part-time work. I don't know. I know a lot of rich people. I don't know many people who are in that level for part-time work.
No, I don't.
Now, they didn't.
I don't know any.
Right. And they didn't disclose this compensation either in any of the regular filings for the Clinton Foundation, you know, in 2010 through the present, or in the recently amended filings for the Clinton Foundation that were filed on the 16th of November, 2015. So they haven't disclosed. They've hit all this. And they're worse. And the way out the door in January of 2013, as Hillary was leading Secretary of State, somehow a portion of the World Bank, known as the International Finance Corporation, decided to make the largest single investment it had ever made in Laureate. For the $100 million itself, it directed a funding control to put 50 in, and then it worked with the Sovereign Wealth Fund of Korea to put another 50 in, all around January 2013. Wouldn't you know that just precisely after then, the finances of Laureate went straight downhill. This thing has today a mountain, according to its recent filing, a mountain of debt, $4.2 billion in debt, and a skinny slice of equity left. After raising $200 million from this group in January, all they have left, according to books, is around $300 million of equity. So that's a highly leveraged, suspect group that is operating today in all sorts of countries, and many countries where you're not allowed to operate a for-profit university system. They nonetheless appear to be doing that. Their filings are riddled with red flags. And, you know, the people who are studying this, the accountants who work for Laureate are the same accountants who work for the Clinton Foundation. The law firm that represents Laureate is the same one that recently supposedly assisted with the amending of the past historical filings of the Clinton Foundation. And all of this matter is currently in front of the SEC, state regulators, and foreign regulators, except they have not as yet twinned their inquiry into what's really going on at the Clinton Foundation, where for its entire existence, the Clinton Foundation has not ever got the audit that it needs to get on an annual basis. Never got a compliant audit. So this thing is poised, I think, to rise in public scrutiny. If the regulators start looking at Laureate hard, they're going to have to look at the foundation hard. And right as we speak, down in Atlanta, right now, Bill Clinton is leading a group, the Clinton Global Initiative group, down in Atlanta, even though in that state, my checking, my discussion with the regulators suggests that no part of the Clinton Foundation is properly registered in the state of Georgia.
Wow. I'll tell you what, I wish I had some really good questions for you, Charles. I'm just listening, and I cannot believe that this information is... Say, how were you able to get this deeply into it without hitting some really thick and tall roadblocks?
Well, you see, actually, that's a credit to the way in which charities are, in fact, you know, regulated. Unlike other bits of the world, even the financial world, it is possible to get a lot of information about a charity if you start with the federal filing, make sure you have the complete one, and then start poking around into the state filing. And then if you've got a lot of extra time, as I do, you start looking at the international filings. And because this thing has been operating in close to 100 countries and in all states and in Washington, D.C., there's a lot of paper to go through. And I have some time, so I took the time. And, you know, I should mention, you know, another piece of this. When this thing was set up, October 23, 1997, Bill was still president of the United States. And that was, for those of you who know your Clinton history, that was a very desperate moment. The Paula Jones lawsuit had been allowed to go forward, while at the same time, the Charlie Tree scandal meant that the presidential expense fund solicitation had to be shut down and restarted. So when you go and you look at this thing in context, this thing was set up originally just to be an archive and research facility in Little Rock, Arkansas. Now, that's something that, you know, everyone would have believed the Clintons could do. The way these things work, normal humans are not allowed to get a foundation set up, public charity set up, for a specific purpose. You can't have a general purpose foundation willing to do anything. You pick a specific purpose. Normal humans are not allowed to radically change the purpose of a public charity without getting approval in advance and without demonstrating at the time they make the change that they accomplished their original purpose or they have good reasons for not having done so and that they're now positioned to accomplish their new purpose. Well, this thing migrated from being an archive and research facility that was supposed to have an endowment to being an archive and research facility that couldn't raise the money it needed. And so it was deeply in debt. To one that wasn't focused on in Arkansas, but instead had migrated its head locus of control into New York City, and suddenly it had been chasing HIV/AIDS theory around the world, fighting climate change around the world, helping people eat more healthily, principally in the United States, and now this Clinton Global Initiative and the Laureate. None of these purposes were contemplated in the original application. There's no evidence that the IRS ever validly authorized these radical changes, which ordinarily would force the shutting down of the foundation to try something like this.
Now, what kind of exposure is the IRS lady, Lois Lerner? This sounds like it could actually go badly for her if this gets very far.
I'm not an expert on how government officials are, you know, in theory disciplined. I mean, she's left, I think, the employment of, she's retired. I don't know what her, you know, legal vulnerability is, but I tell you what, I do know who's really vulnerable. The people who are really vulnerable are all the trustees of the Clinton Foundation. They are extremely vulnerable because the way this thing works, the way charities like this are disciplined is that all it takes is for one state, you know, so long as we have this current guy, Koskinen, as head of the IRS, it's unlikely the IRS would do anything. One state or one foreign government and then a collection of them starts taking a look at this. And typically what would happen is the IRS ultimately would look at this and say, you know what, this was never a charity. The difference between the revenues and the expenses of this thing are profit. We're going to treat it as a corporation. This thing owes corporate income taxes, interest, and penalties. We're going to assess those penalties. And then to all the American donors who took Major League tax deductions to make a donation to the suspect charity, we're going to go against you. And there are quite a few high-profile ones. The Gates Foundation, Fred Eichner in Chicago, a lot of big hitters. George Soros and others have given money and taken tax benefits for giving those donations. IRS could come at all those people and retroactively revoke the charter of this entity, all these entities. And then what would happen is that, you know, people would start suing, and they would sue the trustees, and they would win.
Oh, boy. All right. Well, you know, you looked at you've looked at AIG and the large banks and General Motors and Caterpillar, and the as well as the ongoing global financial and geopolitical crisis. Let's just take a little side trip for a second. You know, the New York Post. I read a story from them yesterday about all these bankers who are jumping out the windows and off their rooftops and swan dives off the scaffolding and stuff like that. Can you give us an idea of why this is happening? It can't be just mass workplace depression. It's you got to be pretty depressed to jump off the roof of the, you know, the 20th floor building there.
Right. Well, yeah. So I started on this back in, you know, I retired actually in 2002, and I had to get tested my children. I spent 5 years with them, getting them off to college and boarding school, and then I got back into this when I saw the credit crisis coming. And, you know, briefly, what's going on now is that for the first time in modern history, technology is actually causing human labor, human jobs, good paying jobs to disappear in total, just as our populations are increasing in size. So that's a major league problem. We haven't had this type of situation on a global basis before, but now because we're all connected globally, and because technology is advancing so rapidly, and if you think about, you know, our own lives, you know, on this matter here, you know, I'm sitting in a public place in Manhattan. You know, your listeners are scattered all over the place. This wouldn't have been possible 10 years ago, 15 years ago, what we're doing on this phone call right now. And, you know, we're seeing this accelerate. We're seeing the people who operate businesses say, you know, we don't really want human labor. It's difficult. It strikes. We'll replace it. At the same time, you know, the economic measurement systems that people use without thinking about them don't really capture what's going on that we understand in the kitchen table. So, you know, people who work in the private sector, they understand it's tough to find customers who are actually going to pay their bills. It's tough to find workers who are really going to be fit in and do well. It's tough to manage people. And in the public sector, I mean, who believes that the public sector is managed properly? Bloated beyond police, can't seem to do anything right. You know, I'm going to pick on Mr. Comey because I think he's an American hero. But how in the heck you pick this shooter up twice at catch and release twice and expect us to believe that we have a system here that's going to protect the American people? So you can pick on all sorts of different parts of this of the pie, but, you know, people are seeing prices rise. You know, they forget the calculations of inflation. Nobody believes that. Things are costing more. Food's costing more. Everything's costing more. Job security's less and less. And meanwhile, these politicians in both parties have piled so much debt. You know, I'm 60 years old. I remember as a kid, you know, people didn't have credit cards. You know, you couldn't have 10 credit cards. You saved up to buy a thing. And now the level of total debt on this economy and the global economy is so high that, and the central bankers, instead of doing the right thing, which they should have done back in 2008-09, that is to raise interest rates, to force restructuring, to take supply out of the global system, they didn't do that. So they created this gigantic bubble. Now in Germany today as we speak, you know, the benchmark rate, you actually lose money when you give it to the German government and take a 10-year credit risk on German debt. Ridiculous. The interest rates are on the floor, below the floor, they're negative. You know, which means that all asset prices from houses to stocks, everything is in the stratosphere. And people are trying to assemble money by, you know, putting it away, spending less each paycheck than they make, those people are getting nothing. So bankers, I think some of these banks, I mean, it's tough to explain this behavior. It's obviously not intelligent. But I think, you know, banks have been maneuvered into a place here where, you know, there's no easy way out. There's going to be a crash, and the people are going to be blamed are the bankers.
Well, okay. All right. Who pushed them into this position? How was this done? I mean, what is the mechanism for pushing a central bank into a bad spot?
Well, I think, you know, what happened was, if you go back to the last crisis, 2007, 2008, 2009, you know, back then in the United States, the benchmark interest rate, the key interest rate, was around 4 or 5% or so. That's the 10-year treasury rate. That's, we investors, that's the rate we look at. In simple terms, you know, if you don't want to take any risk, you can buy a government bond, hold it for 10 years, and you get your money back for sure, in theory, and you'll get some rate of interest that should be very close to inflation. So you're not taking any risk, and you're, you know, better than losing half your money. So that's the benchmark rate. Going long, back long periods of time, that are, you know, fair, comparable periods, if you can get to take an equity risk, you know, take the risk on putting money into stocks, which can go up and go down in value, people like to think that they get, on average, this is an approximation, take 2.5 times the risk-free rate. So that if you have a 5% risk-free rate, you want to get a 12.5% rate of return for taking the common stock risk. And this is rough numbers, right?
Yeah.
Well, the Bush administration and the central banks around the world did, they looked at this math and they said, you know, we can't raise interest rates now, let's lower them. And unfortunately, they lowered them so much that the benchmark 10-year rate, as I mentioned, in Germany is now negative. In the U.S., it's below 2%. Now, you can't make the complex case to a capitalist that, you know, if the risk-free rate is, you know, well, let's say 2%, that they should put up a new factory and you know, take all the risks of you know, designing some new product or whatever to get a 5% rate of return. It just doesn't make any sense. No sensible person would do that. So by pushing these interest rates down, I said when it happened, back in, I forget exactly when, but around late 2008, early 2009, that what we were doing was simply entering financial purgatory. We're neither in hell nor in heaven. We're in purgatory, waiting to find out where we're going to end up. Well, that was 2008. That's a while back. We've been doing this, messing around, running massive deficits at government level, keeping interest rates down, and nothing seems to be working. Incomes are falling, prices are rising, job insecurity is increasing, geopolitical instability is increasing, and I think what you see in this country is you see people on the right and the left saying, you know, we may not like Donald Trump, both ends of the spectrum, but we like one thing he stands for, and that's his famous byline in The Apprentice, you're fired. You know, Americans, and I think around the world you're seeing this, you know, the mass of the voting population wants to see the elite at all levels. The politicians, the bankers, the academics, the wise people, even the media pundits, they want them out because it's not working.
Well, they won't go easy, but I'll tell you what, with this kind of investigative work that you have done and are exposing, this could really, I mean, there are some people in the American public who do not get it. They are blinded by some sort of what seems to me to be an imaginary ideology, but this could potentially really affect this election. You know it. This really could.
Well, I hope so. You know, and one of the things that I've done, you know, people, when you bring something like this to light, you know, some people like it, some people don't like it, and you know, I've had the rap. You say, all you do is criticize. You pointed out problems with General Motors, General Electric, AIG, now the Clinton. Actually, on my website, www.charlesortel.com. There is a 10-point plan, and you may not like all elements of it. If you don't, send me an email. You can contact me through the site. But I outlined 10 ways in which we could change the mess that we're in. Take some pain, and then America would be, because, you know, as bad as things are here, around the world it's a lot worse. So we're the least dirty shirt in the laundry. We need to put some detergent on, jump into the hot water, and take the paint. And when we come out, we will be far better positioned than any other country. And we will therefore be able, everyone in America will be able to do a lot better in a restructured scenario than in the current scenario, where the people in Washington, D.C., you know, are absolutely clueless. They've been compounding the problem this country faces inside the country. And then outside the country, in both parties, what we've been doing is we've been stirring up hornet's nests around the world. It makes no sense what we're doing.
No, it doesn't. And say, what do you make of this German bonds at zero? Did you see that today?
No, I was talking about it. It's negative, actually.
Yeah.
So that's what I'm saying. See, so the issue here is that, you know, that's a bad sign. When interest rates fall that much and go into negative territory, that's a very bad sign. And, you know, what we have had is an excessive amount of intervention in our capital markets by our own central bank, by other central banks, pushing interest rates down in a vain hope that that would prompt people to make investments that would lead to more jobs. And it's been proven it didn't work. It didn't work in Japan. They've been doing this since 1989. Look at Japan. They've got a mountain of debt, huge amount of debt. You know, population, the working age population is shrinking. You know, the place has got disaster after disaster. The companies are not doing well. This is crazy stuff. You know, what we need to do is our government, our own government, has grown to the point where when you count state, federal, and local governments combined, which you could do at the Bureau of Economic Analysis, so-called National Income and Product Account Tables, PIPA tables, they give you all this information to look at yourself. And basically it shows that we spend $6 trillion a year on government. $6 trillion a year. That's absurd.
$6 trillion a year. All right.
$6 trillion. The numbers are, these are government, U.S. government figures. And you can see it for yourself. And, you know, we hear, you know, out of these politicians, there's a new program, a pilot program, of this, of that. Where I come from, you don't get to do a new program unless you prove that the old program actually worked. And, you know, we're taking victory laps for getting the deficit down. The deficit, all told, is massive, approaching $500 billion a year. The total debt on this country is not, you know, people talk about a figure Trump uses, $19 trillion. That's the government debt. You got to add on bank debt, personal debt, total debt. You're talking more like $55 trillion of real debt. And then you got to talk about all the implied obligations, you know, the pension fund payments, the Medicare, and this and that. I mean, we have got to go through a realistic process here where we change the way in which government operates. We change the way in which businesses are regulated. We forget about this idea that, you know, that it makes sense to have the highest corporate income tax rates in the world. That scares companies and jobs out of this country. There are 200 countries in the world. You know, there's no reason why you should have to stay here. You can't punish people. You can't say, you know, a friend of mine, actually, a clever friend of mine, in a funny part of New York State up here, you know, where people typically walk around in, you know, hunting outfits and, you know, fantasy clothes. This guy walks around in a black T-shirt that says, "The beatings will stop when morale improves." And that's the approach the governments are taking now. You know, punish us with taxes, punish us with regulations, and our lives will be better. Ridiculous.
Yeah, it is. So... So that whole situation in Haiti was somehow exploited by the Clintons.
Yeah, that's another big and sad tale. So, you know, the Clinton Foundation itself, the Clinton Foundation itself declared since 97, $2 billion in cumulative revenue. On the 12th of January, 2010, there was a diabolical earthquake. And I mean, it was horrible what happened in Haiti. And Haiti is a place, we've intervened in Haiti. Our government has run Haiti, the U.S. government, in the colonial time, in the past times. Haiti can't catch a break. And so this earthquake happened. Laws were changed locally in Haiti to give control of the Haitian government to Bill Clinton and to a former Haitian prime minister. And the two of them, you know, with the law change, stood on top of all the money that was sent towards Haiti, and a similar pattern emerged. It is no one knows how much money actually was sent towards Haiti. The best estimate I've heard is $14 billion, but 7 times the amount of money that was sent, declared by the Clinton Foundation, went to the small nation of Haiti. Haiti has only 10 million people in it. And, you know, there are riots in the streets now, and have been for a while, because nobody did that. That kind of money didn't reach Haiti. There's been, and Bill Clinton and the former prime minister refused to make a real accounting of the money. And yet, you know, this is the man who supposedly, if Hillary wins, is going to revitalize the American economy. Well, I'd hate to see what he does to this economy based on his track record in Haiti.
Yeah, well, he'll own half of it in cash and gold.
Then there's the question, you know, we can talk a little bit about this one if you want. You know, he talks about fighting HIV/AIDS. That's a really horrible story. Talked about doing that down in Haiti where it's still a problem. But the evidence, there's no evidence, no granular evidence in any Clinton Foundation filing that the monies that have been raised for that purpose actually went for that intended purpose. There's no granular disclosures of, you know, money in and money out by country, by program, by medicine type. There's no audit of anything. No third party has gone and looked at this. None of the figures match up. When you take and you look, when you look at the declarations by donors who say they've given certain amounts of money, like the Gates Foundation in 2009 and 10 to the Clinton Foundation, those declarations do not match up with what the Clintons say. And in certain years, like 7 and 8, when she ran the first time for president, there's over $100 million discrepancy between the amount that won the largest donor, Unitaid, UNITAID, out of Geneva, Switzerland. The reports that they say they gave to the Clinton Foundation appear to me to be $100 million higher than the amount the Clinton Foundation claims it received. So what's the reason for the difference? And who's really checking to make sure that these AIDS medicines were actually sent to the right place, administered correctly? Who's doing that work? Because the Clintons don't have on hand, you know, a staff robust enough to do this work around the world the way they're supposed to do it.
Charles, let me ask you something. Yeah. Where do you put $1 billion? Where do you put $100 million? If I went into my bank with $100 million, they would probably just faint dead away. They wouldn't be able to believe it. Where do you stash this kind of dough?
Well, you see, that's very interesting. There's a system after September 11th. There's a system of reporting. It used to be called Treasury Department Form 90-22.1. And for any American person, individual or corporation, foundation, whatever, if you have in total, I think it is more than $10,000 outside the country, could be in a lot of different accounts or one account, you have to fill out this invasive form, which you list each account, you list the high balance, the low balance, the average balance, the starting balance, the ending balance. You list all the people who have authority over that account. And if you fail to make that filing, you are in serious trouble. So, you know, the first place I'd be looking if I were the FBI at all of these forms, these so-called TD-90, 90-22.1 forms, which are now, I think, morphed into a slightly different name, but the same idea. Look at those forms and compare what they say with what you find when you look in the foreign countries. I think the short answer to your question is that money was diverted into offshore accounts, either offshore financial accounts, offshore real estate, offshore gold.
I know. Panama.
Well, it could well be Panama, Cayman Islands, British Virgin Islands, Mauritius, or all these tax havens. This is when you see a foundation where there are discrepancies at the revenue line. There are actually reports. I mentioned them in my site. Accounts, you know, they think about stuff like this. And so there's a report called Consideration of Fraud in Financial Statement Reporting. It's a very lengthy report. I excerpt part of it on my site. And revenue discrepancies are a huge red flag. I mean, ordinarily, you know, when you run something, you keep track of who your big customers, your big donors are. And when your revenues don't match, there's a problem. They're supposed to match to the penny. But they don't match in the Clinton Foundation case. They've never matched.
Charles, I don't mean to bring up anything that is could be construed to be a deliberately painful question, but just a couple of guys talking here. Aren't you pulling an awful lot? You know the reputation these people have for, shall we say, clearing their path of any obstacles. Aren't you pulling a lot of exposure with this? I already had your webpage go down just as I was looking at it. It came back up, but...
The webpage goes down because there's so many people looking at it.
Okay, good. That's good.
But actually what I did, you know, the first one that I challenged was General Electric back in 2007, starting August 31st, 2007. Now, General Electric is far bigger than the Clinton Foundation and the Clinton. At the time that I drew attention to the problems I saw at General Electric, it had a total enterprise value. That's the value of the net debt and the equity. $900 billion. It controlled NBC and NBC Universal and CNBC and all that. And a lot of, you know, it was a very powerful entity. And the way I did that one, the phrase, of, I forget if I came up with it or somebody else mentioned it, is that you, when you're trying to land a whale,
yeah,
you can't do that you got to let the ocean tire out the whale. And that's what we did with GE, and that's what we're doing here with the Clinton Foundation. When I went down this path, I went to some people I'd met through the GE experience, and I said, this is what I see. This is obviously going to have political ramifications. What do you advise me to do? And they said, well, the first thing you better do is you better share your information with as many people as possible so that it's clear that, you know, doing something out of spite against me will not mean that this fails to get exposed. And so... starting back in March, April of last year, I alerted a team of investigators in multiple countries, and I'm talking serious people, and here in this country, print, radio, television, you name it, magazines, old economy, new economy, many, many people are now focusing on this.
Excellent.
And, this is important. I mean, you know, I put the question back a slightly different way. How many volunteers in our armed forces are in harm's way now, taking real risks so that we can be safe?
Yeah.
The least I can do is take paper risk for a purpose that's important. I mean, one of the things that makes this country truly special is the degree to which we Americans, we hear a tale of woe, and we will pitch in, and there are so many Americans who will do things, you know, real, that are selfless. And it's a wonderful thing. We've done it around the world, and I suspect we'll continue to do it. No matter how tough our situation becomes, there will be a lot of Americans. Right now, there are a lot of Americans who are holding Orlando together, who are, you know, doing their best to set an example, a positive example. So, you know, I'm at a stage in my life where I felt I had to give back a little bit, and this is one thing I can do.
You know, we share that feeling. And that is exactly why we are here. It is a real pleasure to talk to you. I'm looking at your 10 predictions for the Clinton Foundation in 2016. The first one is evaluation of Clinton Foundation public filings and public disclosures will lead prime money sources to abandon support for Hillary Clinton's candidacy. What's prediction number two?
I don't have those in front of me, so you need to just read that out to me.
Okay. All right, I'll tell you what, while I'm downloading this, which I should have done already. Oh, there it is. Good Lord, that was fast. Okay, yeah. Number two is, where is it? No, that's page two. Yeah. Filing submitted on 16 November 2015 by the Clinton Foundation compound legal problems for trustees, for major donors, and for other insiders, which suggests that they're going to run for the exits as soon as it starts getting hot in the kitchen there. Then number three, Clinton Foundation trustees and insiders will grow to understand why they face legal exposure for creating public gain and inurement. What's inurement?
It's a private gain. And inurement, a private gain is just profit. Think of it as profit. But inurement is when a trustee or somebody in position to exercise significant influence over a charity gets a portion of that illegal private gain. So an example would be when Bill Clinton writes a book, which he did published in September of 2007, entitled Giving, and earns $6.4 million for writing a book about his charity. That is enormous.
Yeah.
Okay, another example would be when he gets paid $16.5 million as Chancellor of Laureate. That is enormous. And it's enormous in both of those cases on the early periods, not because he was a trustee. He's the founder of the charity, and you're not allowed to sort of hide behind the fact that you don't have a title. If you function as the chairman but don't have that title, if you function as a trustee but don't have that title, you can be guilty of enormous. And clearly, you know, this is named after him. His family's on the door now. And he wasn't a named trustee, actually, of the Bain Foundation until 2013.
Number four, creation, operation, and attempted refinancing of Laureate Education Incorporated will attract focus for many reasons. And it says, you have written here, during 2007, an investor group led by a Clinton political and foundation donor completed a highly leveraged acquisition of for-profit educational institutions that operate outside and inside the U.S. Once Hillary Clinton joined President Obama's cabinet, Laureate may have received special attention from the U.S. State Department. Then, starting in 2010, Bill Clinton served as Chancellor for Laureate, earning an estimated $16.5 million for part-time work during the course of approximately 4.5 years. Say, I could use a gig like that, especially if it's part-time. Then I could goof off and do cool stuff like Jeb wants to do. Good Lord, man. This is enormous. You know, folks, please go to the website. You must go to charlesortel.com. O-R-T-E-L. Charles, like the normal spelling, O-R-T-E-L. Charles, I just have to ask, as you go through all these things, it's amazing how much collateral information you pick up. So I got to try this one on you. What do you estimate our national debt actually is?
Well, I think I said that, you know, the total debt that's, you know, there's something called, the Federal Reserve puts out statistics which are available online. They're called the so-called Z-1 statistics. If you Google them, they come out quarterly, and they lay out in unbelievable detail the course of the evolution of our economy and our debt position. And I think it's the L1 series of tables that lay out the level of total debt. That debt is, you know, the hard kind of debt, you know, mortgages, bonds, that kind of stuff. That, I think, from memory, is approaching $60 trillion. then you get into the soft debt. You know, how much, you know, the public employees, you know, of states, of cities, of federal employees and their pensions and their health benefits. How would you value that? You know, there are all kinds of other debts. And when people get into that stuff, the estimates rise into the, you know, $150 trillion. $200 trillion. These are massive amounts of money. To put those figures into perspective, there are various estimates of the total financial wealth of the world. You know, people, it's a tough thing to try to guess, because that is, you know, that's legal money and illegal money. And obviously there's no records of the illegal money. So, but the estimates run to say $250 trillion is all the wealth in the world. So how can we have this much debt in one country compared to that much wealth for the whole world? We're clearly out of balance. And, you know, we got to do something about it.
Yeah. The question is what? You know, you were talking about, take a little pain now and straighten this thing out. So while we have a few minutes left together, what kind of pain? I mean, you've outlined on your website a detailed 10-point plan on how Americans might restore our economy, but so many people feel disconnected from the system. They feel like they're spectators to this, not participants at all. So can you just tell us something for some who may not be near a computer, but are listening to this on one of their, you know, their wireless devices, and they can't really look at the site.
Sure. So, I mean, the basic issue is here in America, we're about 318 million people out of 7 billion or so, 7.5 billion people on the planet. We're one country out of 200 countries. So our starting place has to be, you know, there isn't a solution here that's gonna help everybody in the world. It's not going to happen. There's going to be a lot of pain around the world, in particular in, you know, failed states and nearly failed states and across the European Union and other places. So when you accept that, you say, well, what are the strengths of this country? Okay, so we've been divided now for a long time by, you know, let's not get into the politics of it, but, you know, it's been a rough 8 years, maybe even a rough 16 years. So if we got back to thinking about what makes us special versus the rest of the world, we have, a massive amount of land. We have a massive amount of clean water. We have, the infrastructure in places is crumbling, but it's a lot better than places I could tell you about around the world. And so if we get back to basic principles and we say government officials have been asking Americans, including President Obama today, to criticize ourselves, to deflect attention away from the public sector. The one portion of the American economy that has never been put on a diet is the public sector inside our country. What we need to do, we need to do our level best to reward and honor veterans. If anything, we need to spend much more money on veterans than on the military. But when it comes to our domestic government officials, please explain to me why they should be unionized. Please explain that.
Yeah.
They're working for us. They're not working for, some ogre. They're working for the American people. Why do we need public sector unions inside this country? Why do we need a tax system that's so convoluted that even Bill Gates can't understand it? It's absurd. We go to a simple tax system. I propose on that site one standard tax, 12.5%, I think is the number I use, for everything. You don't need to have all these regulations and complex set-asides and all that kind of stuff. We right-size the government. We change its mission. We make it investor-friendly. We make sure we have a sound currency, not one that's backed by hot air and politician slogans, backed by either gold or some proportion, something real. And the spare capital that's washing around the globe, that's sitting in these offshore accounts, that's sitting, away from the United States of America, when they see that they're still militarily powerful, still unified, still strong, still large country, that does have shreds of a legal system left to it, that does have shreds of legal principles left intact, when they see that, we'll see a ton of money flood our way. We'll see jobs return here. There's some other things I propose, but in a nutshell, that's what we need to do. We need to stop coming up with these absurd quests and focus on our basic problem. If we're going to operate, fight wars around the world, why are we happy to, fight these wars in the Middle East to not even a stalemate? We're now approaching having fought these wars for, I think it's four times the length of time that we were in World War II. It's crazy land. We either fight to win or we stop. Well, let's fight to win. Anyway, the details are on the site, but, I'm somebody who just wanted to get the bones of the solution out there. I'm sure people will, they may or may not like elements of the detailed points. Fine. Tell me where I'm wrong and how to improve it, but let's come up with something and let's get it done.
My last question, I guess, Charles, is going to be this. Do we have enough faith in our legal system and the federal courts and so forth? I'm pretty sure we can rely on the ones in Texas. But I really mean that because, this judge down here has done more to oppose some of Obama's initiatives than all the rest of them put together, in my opinion. But I digress. Do you think maybe the solution to, rather than the whole country, seriously, if this debt bubble should burst, and let's say all the bankers jump off the rooftops, well, fine, but we're still, some of them are lovely people, I'm sure, but the mess still remains. Do you have any idea, and this may seem a little fanciful, far-flung, and maybe even a little bit silly, I hope it doesn't, but I'm serious about this. A lot of citizens are talking about withdrawing their states from this union because they do not have a bit of faith in the federal government to follow the law, not at all. So question, it's a two-part question. First part is, do we really think that this Clinton thing can be excised from the body of the nation? And number two, which is slightly different. Given the machinery of the Clintons' positively megalomaniacal apparatus there, when you combine that just that one isolated incident, along with the and roll that into the others that you have investigated, GE and AIG and so forth. Is it possible that the only way to save the, I mean, are we going to have to amputate some states to save the body of the union?
You know, I'd like to think, actually, you know, in my time off at 5-year period, I'll confess that, you know, when I got to college, you know, I got a C, my first semester of freshman year in history, colonial history. And I said, you know, I thought I wanted to be a history major. That settled that, the first C I ever got in my life. And so when I retired, I said, yeah, let's go back and study things that I have really studied carefully before. And one of them was colonial history. My ex-father-in-law and mother-in-law are eminent American historians. And so I was able to consult with them, and I started reading voraciously American history. One of the smartest people in the world, world history, is Thomas Jefferson. We can debate, you know, this and that about him. But when you read the only book that he ever wrote, it's called Notes on the State of Virginia, or Notes on the Present State of Virginia, something like that. And in it, he writes, on just this issue, he says, I don't have it in front of me, something like this, that Americans, our rights, will expire or revive in a convulsion. That's what we're going through right now. He predicted this. He wrote that book in like 1762 or something like that. 1782.
Yeah.
And I think he more or less predicted this. But, you know, after a while, after the American Revolution, people would get tired. They take our rights for granted. He's a very nice paragraph that he writes. I actually excerpted it in one of the research reports that I did. That I issued, I think, on December 1st, 2011. On the cover, I put this quote. And that's what we're going through now. We're going through a convulsion. As tough as it is in portions of this country to pick on, let's say, Toledo or Detroit or whatever, in actual fact, you know, we have a lot of scars, we have a lot of scar tissue, but we're a lot stronger, and I think we fought that battle once between 1861 and 1865. I don't think we're going to go back there. I do think that if we pull together as a nation, and remember, we face a common enemy now. Radical Islamic Jihad is one common enemy. You face others. And I think you're going to find that, you know, if we refocus, if we remember what makes us special and strong, and if we pull together, we'll get through this. We'll do really, really well, far better than other countries.
Yeah. Yeah, well, look, I really mean this. If you'll stay online for just a second after we conclude, I just want to trade numbers with you. Look, this is extraordinary. This is like a professional level extinction potential here for some of these cats out there who have been just living so large for so long. I mean, you know, you have to ask yourself eventually, how many billion dollars do you really need? What are they doing with this money? That's the really worrying thing. What is being done with this money? Who's being paid with it? Is it just to, on a long enough timeline, you know, our everybody's survival level is zero, according to Tyler Durden. So, and that just makes perfect sense. But I'm thinking, you know, Bill Clinton's not 35. So along comes Chelsea. Okay, fine. So I'm sure that she'll take control when mom and dad go on down the road permanently. But I wonder, with this kind of money, where is this money being used by way of influence peddling? I mean, heavy influence peddling. I mean, is there any way to know?
Actually, there is a way. I mean, the correct approach here legally to take would be to appoint a conservator immediately, to order that the Clinton Foundation cease fundraising immediately, because they have demonstrated that, you know, their reports are false and materially misleading, and they've got to stop. In fact, the trustees, if they were smart, some of these trustees, one trustee from Sudan was worth, I think, in the high, above $10 billion. You don't want to continue to do this. Every day you continue operating, you're increasing your legal liability. So the correct approach would be to appoint a conservator, a group of trustees, of new trustees, who would go in, look at the record from the inside, determine what actually happened, produce the correct reports, then go after the people responsible. Much like as happened, for example, with the Madoff fraud, which, by the way, is less. The Madoff fraud was about $60 billion. And all told, including all the tentacles here, remember I said it's about $100 billion.
Good grief. Well, I know you've got an interview coming up pretty soon, and I'm sure that'll. I'm glad that you were able to come on with us and give us some time. Because I know how these news programs go. I hope they give you a special, really. But in the meantime, we've got this special. And just between ourselves, I think you're pretty special. I think you are an intrepid truth seeker. And I think you've done the country an enormous service. If there are some people out there that still want to throw in with the Clintons, well, then fine. But at least if and when they do this, we will know. We'll get an insight into their character. If they think this sort of behavior is okay, what does that say about them? I would say this is a much bigger problem than Trump University ever thought of being. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. And by the way, on that, you know, if Trump is in error there, you know, the people responsible for the error should pay a penalty. You know, I got no problem. It's not like you should be insulated from inquiry if you're a candidate. I mean, if he made a mistake, and a $49 mistake is, you know, to him is not a huge mistake, but it's a mistake. Correct it. Pay the penalties. If he's absolutely, you know, innocent, and this is all, as it were, a trumped up charge, then let's figure that out. But, you know, as you rightly point out, the Laureate thing alone is 100 times the size of Trump University, just Laureate. And this whole thing altogether is, you know, off the top of my head, I can't even do the math. It's so big. It's just many, many times as big at $100 billion.
Wow. Unbelievable. Well, I have a feeling that things are going to heat up as time goes by, and I welcome you to come back on our program at any time. I say our program because you're a part of it. There would be no program without persons like yourself who are while they are individuals, taken all together, they are a very powerful force for change in this country. Everybody wants it. Most people, you could just talk to anybody out there, an unemployed black guy out there. You talk to him for a minute, and he's talking about the same, maybe not about the Clinton Foundation, but he's talking about 9 out of 10 of the same things that everybody else is talking about. The whole, you know, this is an opportunity. This adversity is actually an opportunity for us to become a nation again instead of just a country. Do you agree with that?
I couldn't agree more. Thank you so much for this chance to come on your show and speak with your listeners.
I have to say one last thing before you go, and here it is, and you're entirely welcome. I don't know if you know who Patrick McGoohan is. We do this every once in a while, and I have to do it now. Because, Charles Ortel, you have gloriously, in the manner of McGoohan, the late McGoohan, gloriously illustrated and vindicated the right of the individual to be an individual. And I hereby induct you into our Order of the Ark Knights, and this assembly rises to you, Sir Charles. And that's it.
Well, thank you so much.
All right. Catch you on the next one. Thank you. Hang on for a second. I'll be right with you.
Okay.
Well, you heard it. You heard about Woodward at the beginning and the apparatus behind the whole Nixon ejection from the president's office, the Oval Office. You hear what's going on with the Clinton Foundation. And you know, the scary part about this is, even though this is a large chunk of iceberg tip, there's still a whole huge iceberg underneath it. Men like Charles Ortel and others will continue their investigations as long as they've got their strength to do so, and even when they run low on it, they'll find it and they'll keep going. They are the intrepid truth seekers. Where's the paycheck for Charles? Where? It's not there. He won't be getting a big grant from the foundation, I'm telling you that. So, be discerning. Be careful about those in whom you put your trust. Sharpen those critical thinking skills. They're more important now than ever. Keep your eyes up always and make ready for what's to come. I love you, people. See you tomorrow night.